Okay, so I'm here with Nell Irvin Painter, who is most recently the author of The History of White People.
Yes.
Professor Painter, how are you doing?
Thank you. I'm well. Thank you.
That's good. That's good. I wanted to just start off with a basic, suitably taxonomic question.
Yes, yes.
I was surprised that there was no mention of Dread Scott in this book.
This is not a book about black people.
Yeah. Oh. Oh, I see. I see. Yeah, that was the big surprise.
Yes.
Well, so in that kind of sort of answers my question, but maybe we can talk about this further. I mean, you bring up the Chinese Exclusion Act. Terrible. Nobody really talks about that. Numerous segregation laws.
Yes.
Buck versus Bell. Yeah. Plessy versus Ferguson.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the like. But
you
tend to spend more time on William Ripley.
Yeah,
Emerson,
yeah,
Carlyle,
yeah,
more
right,
than these specific
right,
rulings.
Right,
and so my question to you is, was it really this intellectual or faux intellectual movement
that
really had more of an impact on the viewpoints of race in this country, more so than any specific court ruling or global life?
Well, we need to remember that we have two race systems going on in the United States. In the South, there's the black-white one, and that's the one that gets codified into law. Because from the beginning of the United States, to be white is kind of, as James Baldwin said, the price of the ticket.
Yes.
So in order to be in the polity, you have to be white. But that's not the end of the story. And so there was also codeterminous with black-white people trying to classify white people. So in the 19th century, Emerson, mid-19th century, famine Irish, desperately poor people, dirty, ugly, vile, you know, the problems we associate with poverty.
Yeah.
That was Irish. And so they got racialized as Celts. And so Emerson concentrated on his people, whom he saw as Saxons.
Yeah. The Saxon seed, as he wrote in the English Traits.
Yes.
You briefly bring up Jacques Bergson and Ashley Montague's efforts.
Yes.
And Ashley Montague, I've actually run into a few times.
Really?
He's a very interesting guy. Yeah. Not physically, but book wise.
He
is dead. Yes. So that would be quite interesting.
Yes.
But you. Or rather, they insisted in respectively 1937 and 1942 that race did not exist. But you note that social scientists at the time really could not agree on
this.
And UNESCO's doctrine insisted that race still existed.
Yeah, they danced around it.
The question I have is, why was it necessary during the early 20th century to essentially disprove some of the cephalic index and a lot of the taxonomies that were being laid down, as opposed to simply stating something as bold as, well, race does not exist?
That was too hard.
Oh.
But the disproving is mid-20th century, not early 20th century. The first quarter of the 20th century was the empire of the races of Europe.
Yeah.
And that's the cephalic index, that's the three races, that's Mediterraneans. No, I should say it the other way around, the way they did it, which was Teutonics, Alpines, and Mediterraneans.
Mm-hmm.
And then try to figure out what to do with the Lapps and the Jews.
Yeah, so it was just too hard. You couldn't just believe in something witchcraft of our time, which is what Montague said.
Yes, and it was the witchcraft. Yeah. It still is the witchcraft of our time, I'm afraid. But it was just too hard to let go of. And it took politics, it took national mobilization against the Great Depression and the Second World War, it took the civil rights movement, it took all of that just to get from the races of Europe to black-white. And we're now in the shadow of the genome, the human genome, struggling with whether or not to throw the whole idea out. Some Americans are ready, but many, many are not.
You should read, I'm not sure if you've read it already, Rebecca Skloot's book about Henrietta Lacks.
I know
the book. You'd probably be very interested in talking about genome. But but Ruth Benedict, I should point out, she insisted still on the subdivisions of the Caucasian race, while also declaring Europe too mixed to be separated by race.
Yes.
So this was clearly a concept that was difficult to let go. Why was that?
Because that was in the culture. The idea that there are permanent biological differences, that was in the culture. And you know, the United States was built on the idea that you could permanently separate people. And when the poor people who were doing ill-paid work needed to be rationalized, then race got applied to them, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Even from the very beginnings There was no agreement on how many white races there were, not to mention how many others.
You let's talk about William Ripley and the cephalic index. We mentioned that earlier. You observed that the measurement of heads initially meant little to Americans, and that it was the visual diagrams that really created this impression lodged in these minds. I'm curious, because here you have a guy who was still regularly recognized by the New York Times, as you point out. Why did the cephalic index stick around for so long? It was useful.
It did what needed to be done. It gave a scientific basis to the different races of Europe. The backdrop of this is immigration. We just talked about immigration in the 19th century, when the people to be racialized were the poor immigrants of the time, who were racialized as a Celtic race. And by the early 20th century, the poor people doing the dirty work who needed to be racialized were immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. So the system that Ripley, he didn't invent it. He pulled together.
He pulled it from,
he pulled together a lot of existing scholarship, science, and codified it into this nice, handy threefold system. And that was useful right through the mid-20s with immigration restriction.
Yeah.
We could laugh at it, except that it really made a difference in policy.
And also, I'm not sure if you've heard about this, but as recently as 2002, I'm sure you've heard of the Sparks and Jantz effort to try to disprove Franz Boas.
Then
there was another Columbia study that said, well, Boas's data actually is backed up. So it's interesting that even now, in the 21st century, the supposed century of enlightenment, people are still wanting to cling to the cephalic index.
It's not so much that. I think the question is, Franz Boas has been so, the pace pedestal is so high. And the question is, can you kind of knock him off his pedestal or make his pedestal smaller? Or do you keep him up there as the saint of 20th century anthropology?
So your viewpoint is that this 2002 effort was a way to basically knock off the pedestal as opposed to uphold any of the Ripley results.
I don't think anybody cares about the cephalic index.
I don't think so, aside from outside of neo-Nazis. Winckelmann, you bring up in this book, he's widely regarded as the father of art history. But you point to numerous examples of how Winckelmann's white aesthetic later aligned itself with a racial aesthetic. I'm wondering if you can point to specific works of art in which Winckelmann's aesthetic was not racially motivated. You sort of imply that he was...
Winckelmann was not racially motivated.
Yeah.
Winckelmann is an 18th century figure. So he is, you know, right at the beginning of other people's making race. So his idea was aesthetics. And there, his aesthetic ideal was hard, white, male bodies.
Yeah.
So he was not talking about race. He happened to think that white bodies were better looking.
Yeah.
But he was not racializing them.
Were there any 18th century artistic idealists who went further than Samuel Stanhope Smith, perhaps offering a more enlightened cultural relativism in your view?
Blumenbach himself, the father of Caucasian, the applier of Caucasian to white people to make it stick, Blumenbach was a very interesting character who was not a racist, who was not anti-black, and who actually had one of the early black libraries of the literary output of black authors. And Blumenbach was of many minds. So on the one hand, he insisted that no one group was better looking or better than any other. But on the other hand, white people were prettier. Or at least their skulls were prettier.
We alluded earlier to the prejudices against Irish immigrants. You note that Gustave de Beaumont drew parallels between the Celtic Irish and African Americans. Then we have, of course, Thomas Nast's comparative cartoons. Then, of course, we have Ripley, who would identify the Irish as dark in Races of Britain, using the cephalic index.
Now, Races of Britain is Beddow, not Ripley.
Ripley
was picking up on Beddow. He used Beddow very heavily. So the index of negrescence applied to the British Isles, that is Beddow's idea, which Ripley then imports.
Which very wonderfully ties into this question, because I wanted to ask you about Beto. He was the anthropologist that Ripley, of course, drew from, but Ripley relied on Beto, this measurement of temperament. Mm-hmm. So Beto, I presume, forms the missing link in this corruption of the original Beaumont data. Why was Beto so influential? I mean,
well, remember, Gustave de Beaumont was not an anthropologist.
Yeah.
So his thought goes into literature rather than to anthropology. He didn't measure heads, for instance. Beaumont was a very smart guy and very interesting, and I think he was a person who's we could sit down with today and feel we were still, you know, on the same wavelength. But Beto was a trained anthropologist who did billions of measurements and published lots and lots and lots of tables to show, to base his idea of the importance of cephalic index. I actually read Beto's autobiography. Now, my book leans very heavily on the Princeton University Library, which is a magnificent library, but the Princeton University Library did not have Beto's autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get it through interlibrary loan from the University of California, San Francisco, and nobody had taken it out for 50 years.
Wow. How many other source texts face this predicament?
A lot of them. So, for instance, I own a copy of William Z. Ripley's Races of Europe, which I bought on the internet that was discarded from the Lowell Public Library. And the title page has a stamp on it that says, discarded.
Wow. So in terms of tracking down some of these racist texts, it must have been a considerable endeavor on your part.
No, most of them were in the Princeton Library, because after all, these were recognized scholars.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah.
Was scholarship really one of the key criteria for, or perceived scholarship?
Yes.
At the time?
Yeah. So I did get into cultural issues like Henry Ford and the Saturday Evening Post, but my gauge was cultural relevance and influence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of influence, what would be an example of that? Something that had a very, I mean, like, if
like
someone...
the Saturday Evening Post, for instance, which was largest circulating magazine in the 1920s.
You also note that Alexis de Tocqueville's chapter on race has often been omitted in abridged versions.
I don't know if it's often, but certainly another scholar has found that it has been omitted. I did not do a scholarly search on the... I know I didn't myself compare the versions of Democracy in America. I took the word of another scholar.
Got it. Well, I'm curious because you feel that Tocqueville doesn't entirely face all the facts of the time.
Mm-hmm.
He sends his readers on to
Beaumont. To Beaumont.
Yeah.
That's because his idea was so heavily involved in politics. So he really missed, but by making slavery, I don't know why he, I know why he didn't, because he was writing in the 30s. And in the 1930s, slavery was not a really gigantic issue. If he had been writing in the 1850s, he would have seen it. So in the 1830s, and they were the early 30s, so anti-slavery was just beginning, kind of baby steps. So he didn't see it. He and Beaumont hung around with elites, and they were not interested in anti-slavery in the early 30s.
Yes.
So there was not a big enough bang in American politics regarding slavery for Tocqueville to see this as a really important political issue. So he saw it as a racial issue, and he shoved it over into his admittedly very big chapter on race. But he did not see how this was would become the linchpin of American politics. And of course, he could not foresee the Civil War.
But looking upon what Tocqueville did from a relativist standpoint, is it fair to entirely impugn him for hanging out with the elites?
He was one.
He was an elite,
I'm not impugning him. I'm simply saying that his vision was limited by the people he was with.
And Beaumont is perhaps a more honest depiction of what was going on
at
the time?
No, I think Beaumont was asking different questions.
It's as simple as that?
Well, they were different people.
Yeah. you include your own sketches in this book, drawing from Pliny's description of monstrous people in his natural history. I'm curious why you included your own sketches instead of, say, for example, there are numerous drawings I found from the scientific miscellany from the 11th century. Yes. I'm sure you're familiar.
Well, for two reasons. I just love those little figures. And I am an art student. And the combination of liking the images and not having a clear way to get permission to use others. So the two together led me to make my own drawings.
Okay.
Which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Did you do drawings on any other texts by chance? Or any other sort of impressions to understand why people would draw these impressions, so to speak?
No, I didn't. But since then, I have made a painting of Odalisque with three different Odalisque images that are in the book.
You bring up El Proletario and the Wobblies as an example of building off of David Walker's charges against the abuse of black Americans.
I don't know if they knew David Walker. Yeah. I think they were thinking along similar parallel lines.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this because El Proletario, the particular article you quote, is not race struggle, but class struggle.
Yes.
That's the conclusion reached by the editorial. But you point out that El Proletario came a little early. But I'm curious because in 1829 and 1830, Walker got the attention of William Lloyd Garrison. Mm-hmm. The mayors of Savannah and Boston also took umbrage with him. Yeah. And I'm curious, since Walker made such a serious impact, why do you feel that the Italian syndicalists weren't able to make that particular impact? Why was it too early?
For the syndicalists, they affected their circle.
Yeah.
But the First World War really hurt the immigrant press. And so that, I think, snuffed out that tradition of immigrant radicalism, really. If the First World War had not been so hard on the immigrant press, that might have had a longer lineage.
Yeah. So basically polemics along these lines are better in times where it's in times of peace as opposed to war.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I'm just curious about the specific conditions between Walker and El Proletario. I mean,
you see, we don't know what would have happened to Walker if he had lived.
Yeah.
And Walker's work during my own lifetime, I have seen it go from being extremely obscure to being routinely quoted.
Yeah.
So it's a question of what we want to know when we want to know it.
You are careful to write, Harvard's importance in eugenics does not imply some nefarious scheme or even a mean-spirited ambience. Rather, Harvard's importance in this story attests to the scholarly respectability of eugenics ideas at the time.
And that could be said about Princeton or Yale or any of the other lofty institutions.
But it is curious to me, I mean, if we recognize today Yerkes and Ripley's stuff as junk science, essentially. Mm-hmm. Why at the time were these ideas so respected? Why did some of these people get tenured at Harvard?
Indeed.
I mean, it couldn't have just been Harvard's prestige.
Yeah.
It had to be something else, I suppose.
Well, we're talking about what was considered good science at the time.
Yeah.
That was the knowledge that our culture needed at the time. And after all, Ripley consulted all sorts of authorities, European authorities, American authorities, and so forth. So, you know, he had a really big bibliography, and he followed the rules.
Yeah. I'm wondering if someone attempted something along those lines today, I guess the internet would kill it, I suppose.
Not necessarily. Yeah. If it was something that we all agreed upon. Well, for instance, we're seeing in medical field right now. Recently, I read a report in the New York Times by a doctor saying there are just too many prostate cancer screenings. But a year or so ago, that was considered good science to have everybody screened.
Yeah.
So things change.
I wanted to talk about Emerson, who you really take to task in this book. You devote a whole chapter to English traits.
Yeah, there are three Emerson chapters.
Yes, see, there's three Emerson chapters. Yeah. But English traits seems to be the one key text with which
it
a lot of...
It is the key text for this reason.
Yeah, but I just wanted to ask you about this. You know, later in the book that Henry Ford was an admirer of English traits.
Yes,
But in the book that you cited from, because I was really curious about this, Nell Neil Baldwin's Henry Ford and the Jews. Baldwin notes that it was Emerson's essay Compensation that Ford favored above all else, and he even handed that out as gifts. Mm-hmm. And that essay doesn't contain any reference to race. Mm-hmm. You also state that Theodore Roosevelt echoes the phrase hideous brutality in English Traits, but in English Traits, Emerson uses the word hideous only once in reference to the injustice of pauperism. And granted, there are issues with pauperism related to the Saxon Seed, which we had mentioned earlier. But I just want to ask, because I don't disagree with you, that Emerson's views on the Irish, his drawings upon Robert Knox, these are problematic.
I'm not saying that Emerson is a bad man.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that Emerson, because of his importance in American culture, by focusing on these themes and presenting them, orchestrating them in his impeccable prose, made it acceptable. So it's not that I'm castigating Emerson. Yeah. I'm trying to place him in an intellectual theme.
Yeah, but in the case of Henry Ford drawing more upon Compensation, say, than English Traits, that's where I was kind of just, you know, my question mark went up. Yeah.
But we're doing Henry Ford, what, 60, 70 years after, after Emerson.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is that in terms of picking and choosing one's values from Emerson, like Ralph Ellison, for example, he was named after Ralph Waldo Emerson and actually took a lot from the Transcendentalists.
Yeah. Oh, there's
for his...
a lot of to Emerson.
Yeah.
Emerson's an extraordinary figure. And one of his contemporaries said that he embodies the whole of American learning.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, he did.
But going back to the question of relativism, can he be let off the hook somewhat simply because he was, in part, an abolitionist? Maybe he didn't go all the way.
No, we're talking about different things. Hmm. We're talking about different things. Because he had one set of views doesn't change what we think about another set of views. You can still respect Emerson for his central role in the American Renaissance and still know about his Saxonism.
I also wanted to ask you about Robert Chambers' Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, which was a key text that Emerson drew from in order to have the Saxonism that we're talking about. I'm wondering if, it, by way of being revered by Emerson, the great man of letters, whether this may have done more damage by influence than, say, anything Darwin put out there and any twisted eugenic view that was taken.
You're talking about
Darwin?
Chambers?
Yes, I'm talking about Chambers.
Yeah, no, Darwin did in Chambers. Mm-hmm. Because Chambers was sort of groping for what we now see as a kind of evolutionary view. But Darwin was the person who was recognized at the time.
Yeah.
So it's Darwin, not Emerson.
So, I mean, in terms of Darwin versus Chambers, though, I think that's my question, whether Chambers, maybe we're understating the influence of Chambers in relation to the regrettable eugenics that came decades later.
Darwin is so much clearer than Chambers. Chambers backed and filled and equivocated. I actually read that section of Chambers, and it's not very clear.
So he was not
as effective as an author as Darwin.
Well, Melvin Painter, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with
you. Ah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Vision, dreams of passion. And all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do. Baby.
Telling your body to come along, but white lies blow away.
Blow! Rockin'! Blow! Ticket to ride, White Line Highway. Tell all your friends they can go my way. Pay your toll, sell your soul. Pound for pound costs more than gold. The longer you stay, the more you pay. My white lines go a long way. Either up your nose or through your vein. We're nothing